And we have got Max Orr, director of the Carolina, executive director of the Carolina Public Humanities. There's too many, like, directorships
Put
and
me
executive
in my place.
Directorships. Person who runs the Carolina Public Humanities for another round of Oh, the Humanities, taking a look at scholarship and events and happenings in Carolina having to do with the humanities. We've got a really, really cool event to talk about and a really cool new book as well that I've got sitting here in front of me. But Max, how are you? Take it away.
I'm very good. And thank you for having me, Aaron. It's always a pleasure to be here, despite the gray skies and impending coldness.
It's muggy today, isn't it?
It is. But apparently it's going to be cold tonight. But let's not talk about the weather. Let's talk about things that happened today. And I want to tell you, you know full well my methodology is to simply go on Wikipedia and look at the 500 things that happened. And it was grim today trying to tie it. So here's the one thing I found that has maybe even remotely to do with what we're talking about today. In 1855, Michigan State University was founded. And
Good.
You say, what is that? What does that matter? And I'm going to ask
you. My Spartans. Hey.
There you go. Well, I'm going to ask you a few questions. Do you know what the first public university in the nation was?
Are we going. Well, is it UNC?
Yes, it
UNC,
was.
UNC,
yeah.
UGA, UVA, a whole bunch.
They're all fighting with each other.
They're all fighting with each other.
But 1789 charter, 1793, the first cornerstone of Old East, and 1795, the first students were enrolled, and it gave out the first degrees from a public university in the 18th century. And here's another thing. I'm going to ask you a question, Aaron. Do you know what which college Kiplinger's has rated the best value education in the United States in 17 years?
17
years in a row
now?
In 2017. Yes, is, of course, the University of North Carolina.
The year that streak ends, it's going to be a
We're not going to know about it.
We're not going to know about it. Right.
So I bring those up because we have a wonderful program coming up this Saturday, February 17th, called UNC in State Politics, Then and Now. And what we need to think about, this is such a great value for education. It comes from, there's a combination, of course, state support, but there's also a state mission that the university is trying to fulfill. And of course, this means we can't avoid things like state politics. And so what I've brought two guests here who are going to be the speakers for this weekend seminar. They are Ken Zagrai. He's a public historian and lecturer at UNC. And I've also brought Andrew Perrin, professor of sociology. And they are the then and the now of this UNC in state politics.
Awesome.
So welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I should mention Kenneth Zagrai just published Print News and Raise Hell, which I've got in my hands right now, like literally, like just in the last couple of months.
Yeah,
read
the rest of the title.
News and Raise Hell, The Daily Tar Heel and the Evolution of a Modern University. So this is the history
UNC
of the Daily
Press.
Tar Heel, right?
Yes.
Yeah, really cool.
UNCPress.org.
Very cool. All right.
So what can you tell us? What are a few things that emerge from that then in state politics? Can you pick a few signal things that really stand out in the book about the relationship between the university and the state and its political institutions as they emerge in the Daily Tar Heel?
Well, as you know, I'm going to talk about three specific instances on Saturday. But the first thing I want to say is there is no debate about the first public university. As a historian, I can tell you. I mean, the UVA claim is really the silliest, but we won't go there. Yes, we were the first public university in the country. And as a result, the whole interaction between the political structure, the state legislature, and the university had to evolve over time. And the university that we have today is very different than the university of the 18th and 19th centuries. The antebellum university was much more of a classical education that was meant for white male students only, most of whom came from, they were sons of the planter elite and the wealthy in the South. But after the Civil War and Reconstruction, there was a sort of a battle, actually, for the heart and soul of the new university to be part of the new South. And in that, out of that was born, and I won't go into detail, you can read the book, the research institution that we have today. That said, the legislature and the university have always had a complicated relationship, which was not as it is today. The university was funded early on largely on its own, and it struggled for money. It did not receive consistently annual appropriations. And what's interesting about what I'm going to talk about on Saturday is that starting in the 1920s, as a result of the progressive movement in the United States and in North Carolina, and the growth of the university at that time, the legislature became much more involved, especially financially. Once that happened, what soon followed after that was politics. So the three specific examples are, the first one is in 1925, when a bill was introduced in the state legislature to ban the teaching of evolution at Carolina, public schools generally, but it was aimed at Carolina. And it was part of a movement, a year or so later, the Scopes Monkey Trial and so forth. Mm-hmm. But it was the first time that the legislature or any politician in North Carolina had really tried to reach in and restrict academic freedom. And it's part of a larger political shift that occurs. The second incident that I'm going to talk about is the fairly well-known speaker ban of the 1960s, when in 1963 the legislature passed an act ostensibly restricting speakers who were of a communist nature. There were various iterations of what that
fellow
meant.
Travelers,
yeah,
as they
that
will,
sort of thing,
right?
People who had pled the fifth and so forth. But in reality, what that bill was about was anger in the legislature about the civil rights activities that were occurring not only in the state but in Chapel Hill specifically. And there had been all of this talk at the time about communists infiltrating the civil rights movement. So, and they couldn't actually come out and ban civil rights protests, so they tried to ban the protesters. There are certain relationships, and maybe you're going to talk about this, between that and the HB2 battle that occurs later. The third that I'm going to talk about is an interesting incident that's been sort of lost, and that is that in April of 1971, the Tar Heel printed a full-page expose, if you will, about what it was like to be gay in Chapel Hill. Now, this is very early, and they published a large photograph of two men from the neck down, and they're not wearing shirts. They're in an embrace, and they're holding each other in a very romantic embrace. It's 1971.
Wow.
A member of the state legislature got a hold of this. Certain conservative students were very angry about it. He called it rank pornography and had a bill introduced in the state legislature to try to shut down the Daily Tar Heel. So these are all incidents where the state legislature tried to get into. The first one has to do with academic freedom. The second one has to do with freedom of speech. And the third one has to do with free press. Wow. So those are three examples.
That's really fascinating. Since the 1920s, when they really started this, have there been periods when the legislature has entirely pulled back, or has it always been just sort of trying to get involved to a degree?
Yeah. I was thinking about this in advance of the talk on Saturday, and there does seem to be a relationship, which I'll get more in detail into on Saturday, between times when the legislature is anteing up larger sums of money, and when individuals decide that because they're doing this, they should have more say in what's going on. There are interesting parallels. There were large appropriations made close to those periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's some relationship there.
So it reminds me of when students start paying more tuition, they begin to see themselves as consumers. In the same way, when the legislature mm-hmm. gives more money, they begin to see themselves as having some sort of control,
ownership.
Of it, yeah.
Interesting. Speaking with Max Ory, you just heard him, Kenneth Joel Zagrai. Zagrai, is that
right? That's right.
Zagrai,
you got it right.
Who is the author of, well, I'm just going with what Max said, Print News and Raise Hell, The Daily Tar Heel and the Evolution of a Modern University. That's the new book. The discussion is going to be on Saturday, February 17th from 9 a.m. to 12:30. Humanities.unc.edu is the website. Go there and find out more. Kenneth's going to be one of two speakers. The other one is Andy Perrin, professor of sociology and the author of a couple of books as well, American Democracy, Tocqueville Town Halls and Twitter, and Citizen Speak, The Democratic Imagination in American Life. Also works with the Frankfurt School as well, right?
Indeed I do, yes.
So your talk is going to be focusing on the now, right?
I'm going to do my best to pick up where Dr. Zagrai leaves off. And, you know, these questions about how the legislature operates and their relationship to the university is really fascinating, in part because, in fact, they do have a appropriate role of oversight. It's a public institution. It's owned by the public. And I like to say, when they say our students are their customers, that no, in fact, the public are our customers. That's not the legislature per se, but, you know, they have a reasonable and appropriate role. And so the question is, you know, how do we think about outstanding educational quality and academic freedom in the context of also being a public agency subject to public control. And so those are, you know, those are questions that are never truly solved. They're questions to be kind of dealt with, you know, over time. And the way I like to think about it is we are, in a certain sense, the very best of the truly public institutions and the most public of the truly great institutions. And in part, that's because the legislature over the years is pretty good at leaving us alone and really recognizing that great educational quality, great research quality is best left to a faculty who's really good at their jobs.
I've got kind of an ill-formed question, so I apologize in advance for this, but your work focuses on democratic participation and seems to be participation sort of beyond or outside the typical like public hearing kind of channels, like people going out on social media today and people going out and protesting and just activity
yeah.
like that. What do we glean from that in the history of sort of public participation in that sense that can teach us about the way that these debates are taking shape
sure,
today?
I mean,
there's a lot of positive and negatives there.
Absolutely. And in fact, one of the key elements in what's called the Blueprint for Next, you know, the big sort of strategy document for the university is education for democracy. And the question really is, what can universities do, what can our universities do to help prepare students at all levels to be the best citizens that they can be. And in part, that really is about careful assessment of evidence, about questioning even the most core beliefs that they have, and at the capacity to think and talk with people they disagree with. And so I think that the capacity to really engage across difference is one of the things universities can and often are really good at doing. So I think that some of those are some of the key ways that universities in general and ours in particular can kind of be one of the cornerstones of democratic engagement.
Go ahead, Ken.
I was just going to say, really, one of the main themes of the book is the democratization of the university over time, how we went from being a small institution that was for the white male socially planner elite of the antebellum era to where we are today, and I go into great detail with regard to the struggle and the process of democratization that involved race, gender, mm-hmm. and then it toward the end, a sexual identity,
mm-hmm.
And that really that's at the core of this story of what this and how we are really now a public university in the complete sense that we were not in the 18th century, even in the late 19th century, even well into the 20th century.
Yeah.
It's kind of the American university in general made that move over the last few decades and the last couple of centuries. What's unique about that experience at UNC?
Well, first of all, that it's a public institution.
Right, right.
And it's the first public institution. And also that it has, you know, it's always had the reputation as being the mecca of the South and being more progressive, supposedly, than... It's another thing that's very interesting in the research I found that, you know, the university has and always has had a very strong conservative core. This mantle of liberalism or even extreme left politics is really... to some extent, a facade. There is and always has been a very conservative core to all elements of the university, whether it's the student body or the faculty or the administration. And what what has played out in the course of this research was how what we call the dynamic tension that's occurred between these factors, and at the same time trying to move the university forward in terms of not only democratization but in terms of you know pedagogical process and progress, and in terms of how it helps the state and beyond in what it does.
You know, I'm wondering for both of you. As we see this change in our own democratic political culture, widespread over the United States, of increasing polarization, increasing siloing, it seems to me that there's always been a sort of, there's a patriotism for the university and the state, whether you're on the right or on the left, you know that the state, you Tar Heels, et cetera, this is something to be proud of in the state. And so when these tensions in the past would develop that you were talking about, Ken, that there seemed to be it stretches to a point, but there's still this consensus. I just am wondering, are we at a critical place in our political culture right now that is changing the dynamic of state and in state university relations?
I won't speak to the history of it. I'm not a historian, mm-hmm. And my view is probably overly short term. But I do think that there's more of a consensus around the value of higher education, the value of public higher education, than you might think looking at, I don't know, Twitter or the public sphere right now, mm-hmm. right? That the economic benefits are really clear, the civic benefits are really clear, and the truth is, when push comes to shove, even people who are very critical of the university, they want to send their kids there. They recognize the value of the research enterprise. So I think, you know, the bottom line is most people really do recognize the value of the, you know, a really great intellectual core for the state, which is what the university provides right now.
Kenneth, I want to get you to have the last word on that. We've got to wrap up in a second, but talk about that in a historical context. There have been these conflicts between the legislature and the university in the past. What's different, if anything, now versus then?
Well, I had another thought, actually, as this was being discussed,
yeah.
that I think all three of us, having taught at the university, may have had this experience. You know, talk to students who say, that come from various parts of the state or rural areas in the South, and again, the parents and the families are very proud to send them to the university. But, you know, as they're putting them in the car or whatever on the way, they say to them, now don't let those crazy liberal professors brainwash you. you know, and so there has been this interesting sort of relationship between those two things. I don't know. I do think that the most interesting recent example of this, even though it wasn't directly pointed at the university, was HB2, mm-hmm. and how the legislature tried to reach into the public sphere generally and control based on, you know, largely hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
I will say one last thing, if I can, which is that there's also lots of sports history in this book, unknown sports history. I tell the story in there of how basketball came to Carolina. It's an untold story.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll bring you back for that one.
Yeah,
well,
yeah,
sure.
I'm fascinated about the story of 71. I read, just happened to stumble upon this. People in the know, I've since discovered, know about this Life magazine article about homosexuality in America, which was incredibly forward-thinking and progressive, that came out in the mid-1970s. But I was just reading through
earlier.
Old Life magazines.
That's 71.
And this
that's
is 1971. Yeah, this is even earlier than that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, what, when was Stonewall? 69?
69, yeah.
So it's 2 years later.
That's incredible. Now, we got, again, Kenneth Joel Zagrai and Andrew Perrin are going to be the speakers at this event that's on Saturday at 9 a.m. to 12:30, February 17th. It's called UNC and State Politics Then and Now. Where is it?
Max? It's going to be at the Center for School Leadership Development, but please go to the website and sign up there or call us at 919-962-1544 to be sure we can reserve a seat for you. And, of course, UNC students, faculty, and staff students are free, and faculty and staff have much reduced ticket prices on that.
Humanities.unc.edu is the website. Everyone, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you.